You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. In February of 2017, most Americans were focused on domestic news as Donald Trump's first full month in office unfolded. Meanwhile, in Malaysia, Kim Jong-un and other North Koreans had perfectly executed the most baffling assassination plot of all time. After Kim Jong-un's half-brother and rival, Kim Jong-nam, ended up dead in the middle of the Kuala Lumpur International Airport, the country was shocked to learn that two young women were to blame for his murder. While they were both caught on closed-circuit TV footage, both women claimed to have no idea they had killed someone and that they had been hired to pull a simple prank for a TV show. Now, a new documentary called Assassins questions every angle of this case, from human trafficking to geopolitical espionage to the secretive dynamics of the North Korean dynasty. The film investigates the two young women caught in a global spy thriller and asks, were they really trained killers, or was there a chance that they had actually been duped into murdering a man in broad daylight? Today I'm joined by director-producer Ryan White, the award-winning filmmaker behind HBO's The Case Against Eight, Netflix's The Keepers, and now this riveting real-life story of political intrigue. He recounts the official events of February 13, 2017, when Kim Jong-nam was murdered with the deadly VX nerve agent, questions the press's sensational portrayal of two young Southeast Asian women as diabolical Black Widow assassins, and reveals that the truth of what happened is even more bizarre than anything that the news media or Hollywood could come up with. Ryan discusses his belief that the two women were unwitting pawns of North Korea's Kim Jong-un, explains why the dictator would want to murder his own brother in such a sensational manner, and shares how eight North Korean agents suspected of masterminding the plot managed to slip right through the hands of Malaysian authorities. Plus, he recalls covering every moment of the very public show trial of the two accused murderers, what it was like to become so emotionally invested in the fate of two people he had never even met, and what kind of security precautions he had to take as he unraveled an international thriller involving one of the world's most ruthless strongmen. Coming up with documentary filmmaker Ryan White in just a moment. Today I'm talking with award-winning director and producer Ryan White, who has a compelling new documentary about the 2017 assassination of Kim Jong-un's half-brother and the two young women who were accused of masterminding it. The film is called Assassins, and it opens in theaters December 11th, followed by a video-on-demand release January 15th. Ryan White, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
Well, first of all, Ryan, what a terrific film. I mean, it had some real cloak and dagger stuff in here. It's just fascinating. And, you know, I don't think that I'm alone in that. I remember when the assassination happened in 2017 and maybe some vague facts surrounding it, but I did not even know the half of the story until I watched this film. Is that pretty much a common reaction that you're hearing?
100%. You are absolutely not alone. In fact, I am in the exact same boat as you. So, yeah. The reason for that is if you look back at when this assassination happened, it was February of 2017. So in the weeks prior, Trump had just been inaugurated. So our news media was being totally overrun by the Trump show, as it has been for the 4 years afterwards. But this was sort of the beginning of that trend. And, you know, what was one of the biggest political assassinations of our lifetime that I think normally would have gotten months of coverage was a blip on the radar. It was a headline for one day, and then it dissipated into the ether. And so I think most Americans kind of have a glimmer of recognition when they hear about this assassination. They usually know that two women were involved because that was such a sensational detail. But very few people know the backstory, and almost nobody knows what happened to the two women who went on trial for murder, and they were on death row. So I was the exact same way. And then in late 2017, a journalist approached me. His name is Doug Bott Clark, and he was writing an article about this story for GQ magazine that was a very deep dive investigative look into the life of one of the women who had assassinated Kim Jong-nam. And the premise of that story essentially was Siti Aisha, that's her name, admits to assassinating Kim Jong-nam, but she says she thought she was on a reality show when she did it, and she didn't know she was assassinating someone. So Doug called me while he was writing that article, and it seemed like the most inconceivable bananas defense for a political assassination ever, but I was very compelled. And Doug is a very credible journalist. And a few weeks later, I was on a flight with him to Malaysia where this assassination happened, meeting all of his sources. And that's where it all began. I left that shoot in Malaysia thinking, like, even if this isn't true, this story is too wild not to be told.
Yeah. And like you said, when it happened, it was so quickly overshadowed by the daily chaos of the first month or so of the Trump presidency that a lot of us forgot about it or never really heard what happened with all of this. So just to begin with, I'm wondering if you could take us back to the events of February 13th, 2017, and remind us of the broad strokes of what happened or what was reported in the media. What was the initial story in the press?
Sure. So the very initial reports were because of a little bit of leaked CCTV footage from the Kuala Lumpur airport that day, which showed two women approaching a man's face. We now know that man was Kim Jong-nam, Kim Jong-un's older brother, approaching him from separate directions and touching his face. And then within an hour, he died. Now we know that the two women had VX nerve agent on their hands, which is the most lethal chemical weapon, and that one of the women was wearing an LOL sweatshirt, which grabbed huge headlines at the time. She was sort of seen as this maniacal, brazen, femme fatale character who assassinated this man and then wandered off, you know? And so those were the initial reports. And then you know, in the days and months after the story of the women claiming that they did not know what they were doing, that they did not even, in fact, know each other or know that somebody had died as a result of their so-called prank, those stories started to emerge in the months following the attack when the women were arrested.
I want to ask you about the method of the murder. How quickly does a nerve agent like VX take effect?
Supposedly, according to chemical experts from the trial, it takes effect immediately. So especially when rubbed in a way that enters an orifice. So if it can enter the bloodstream right away, you stand no chance. So Kim Jong-nam started feeling the effects immediately, supposedly, and within an hour was dead. I often get asked why the women, because they did it with their bare hands, did not die. And that's presumably because it did not go through an orifice of their skin. Okay. They had been conditioned, if you believe them, in the months leading up to this, to when they were playing pranks all over Southeast Asia, to wash their hands after this prank because they had been playing it with Johnson baby oil, which was quite sticky, I guess. So they had always been washing their hands after they played these supposed pranks. And so this day was no different. They immediately, you can see it in the CCTV, after they touched Kim Jong-nam's face, they both go to separate bathrooms, wash their hands, and then take taxis back home into the city of Kuala Lumpur.
And I'm assuming that this VX nerve agent is not commonly available. It's not like these two women could have gone down to the pharmacist and bought a few hundred milligrams of VX. So who usually has access to this sort of stuff?
Virtually nobody. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of the highest banned substances in the world. So I think maybe the upper echelons of foreign governments might have access to it. Mm-hmm. But I believe this is one of the only times it's ever been used against a civilian. I remember that, I think it was that subway attack in Tokyo or somewhere in Japan in the 90s.
Yeah, I remember that.
Where someone used it against people mm-hmm. and killed them. But I think that's one of the very few times. So that was a big question from the very beginning. Like, your average citizen can't cook up VX. It's an incredibly... dangerous substance that needs the utmost expertise to be cooked accurately and safely. Mm-hmm. And so that was a big question all along, is how did this substance even make its way across the Malaysian border to be used against Kim Jong-nam when he was traveling there?
Yeah, so this would seem to narrow it down to state actors and presumably, more specifically, North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. But I guess my question is why? You know, his brother was already basically living in exile, so what would have been the urgency to take him out of the picture and to do so in such a dramatic fashion?
There's a lot of reasons why. There's two separate questions here. The why Kim Jong-nam was a threat, there are a lot of reasons. So Kim Jong-nam, first of all, was the oldest brother. He was the oldest son of Kim Jong-il. So he had a very rightful stake to the throne. He was passed up for various reasons that we explore in our documentary in favor of Kim Jong-un. But he was very publicly questioning Kim Jong-un's legitimacy. You know, we have him on camera questioning whether hereditary succession should even be a thing. Kim Jong-nam was seen as much more Western-leaning in his political philosophy. And he was also saying publicly, you know, I hope one day the North Korean people have a better life. He also, which we explore in the film, had very solid ties to both the Chinese government and the U.S. government, which both are obviously the biggest threat to the Kim regime. China, because they're North Korea's biggest ally, and Kim Jong-nam was living in Macau, a territory of China, and being protected by China. But he was also, which we reveal in the film, working as an informant for the CIA, you know, North Korea's archenemy. So he was challenging his brother in many ways. And until, you know, there's even stories that this wasn't the first assassination attempt on his life, and that in fact he had sent a letter to his younger brother mm-hmm. asking him to spare his life. So most people think Kim Jong-nam's days were numbered, and that the event that eventually precipitated them pulling the trigger at this moment was a meeting that he had just had with the CIA.
Okay, so I get why Kim Jong-un would want him out of the way, but why not do it quietly in the dead of night? Why do it in broad daylight and in such a dramatic and public way with literally dozens of witnesses and security cameras all over the place?
Your guess is as good as mine on why do it in such a spectacular fashion. The North Korean MO before this for assassination supposedly had been, you know, your traditional dark alleyway, quiet assassination. So why pull off such a public, brazen, international incident when you're having your brother assassinated? And the two reasons most presumed for that are, one, because it was so publicly humiliating to his brother to go out in that fashion. He, you know, assassinated him in the most embarrassing and public of ways. And two, perhaps more importantly, it sent a shiver down the spine of the entire world. You know, this is not, you know, Kim Jong-un had had his uncle executed in the years prior to this, but that was on North Korean soil. This was happening in a major international airport on camera by people who supposedly didn't even know what they were doing when they did it. So if you can imagine the chilling effect that would have across any foreign governments or people that were challenging Kim Jong-un's leadership. And it worked. I mean, that's the fact of the matter. This is sort of the perfect crime in some ways, because North Korea has faced no has faced no accountability for this, and it did create that chilling effect around the world, and therefore was another force in consolidating Kim Jong-un's power that we've seen over the last decade.
And as you mentioned earlier, in the media, these two young women, Dwan and City, were portrayed as sort of these Black Widow assassins, but their backgrounds would really seem to suggest anything but. Are you aware that they had any connection whatsoever on their own to Kim Jong-nam, much less a reason to kill the guy?
Yeah, I mean, the central question at the center of our film, always, that we had to remind ourselves is, who are these women and what led them to this moment? Mm-hmm. So that's the main investigation of the film. You know, of course, it has massive geopolitical framework and web overarching this film, and there's the whole history of the Kim regime. But the central question is, who are these women? And in our 2 years of telling this story and investigation, we were able to trace their path that led them up to this moment in the airport. And, you know, I leave it to the audience of our film to decide whether they think the women are guilty or innocent. But regardless, I think the film's goal was to humanize them in a way that you understood what led to this moment. So as far as the evidence itself goes, I'm still yet to see a shred of evidence that confirms that the women were trained assassins, that they knew they were about to kill somebody. Mm-hmm. And this is coming from someone who's seen all of the text messages, all of the Facebook profiles, all of the flight paths, all of the CCTV footage from the day went down, you know, all of the ways they were conditioned by these supposed Japanese YouTube producers who ended up being North Korean spies. I'm yet to see a shred of evidence saying that they were aware of who they were working with, or of who their victim might be, or that they were about to pull off something nefarious. So if they are in fact trained assassins, they really are those Black Widow types that have been able to create profiles for years prior that has in total invisibility to it about what their real identities are.
Yeah, I have to say, you know, if it weren't so tragic, it would almost sound like the plot to a dark comedy. I mean, a couple of aspiring social media stars, model actresses sign up for a prank show in their mind and end up getting involved in an international conspiracy. If there was so much writing on this for Kim Jong-un, why would he trust this job to a couple of aspiring actresses instead of professional assassins?
You know, there's all of these theories around that, a lot having to do with Kim Jong-un's personality, so to speak, and his intense interest in pop culture. You know, he grew up on Jean-Claude Van Damme movies. And so there's a lot of speculation that it was fun for him in that type of way.
Really?
But, you know, why you would recruit two unsuspecting women instead of just using your own North Korean operatives who were also there. I mean, we can prove that on camera, which you'll see in the film. We traced the way the six North Korean operatives are moving around the airport as well. They could have pulled it off just as easily. So, you know, your guess is good as mine. I think that would involve a deep dive into the psyche of Kim Jong-un, which unfortunately he didn't give us an interview for the film. So, you know, these are all guesses based on people that have traced his history. But, you know, a lot of the question is he loves a spectacle. And this was the greatest spectacle he could create for an assassination.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that they did choose these two young women, it speaks to some broader themes like social media culture, our desperation for money and celebrity, and powerful men preying on vulnerable young women. In that sense, even though these events take place worlds away, I think it's very relatable for American audiences.
Absolutely. You know, I think it was very easy at the beginning to otherize these women and assume their guilt and assume that they really were these trained assassin femme fatale types. And that, you know, I'm guilty of that as well. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, now having covered this story for 2 years, I think there is a universality to these two women's trajectories that we see every day all over the world, you know? And ultimately, I think this story is a cautionary tale about social media and the internet probably the worst case scenario. I'm not claiming that this story happens every day, but this is probably the most exaggerated, on steroids, worst case scenario version of what can happen when social media goes wrong. But absolutely, it's also about the exploitation of young women, which is also happening worldwide. Yeah. You know, there's a whole story here of human trafficking and sex work and, you know, women from the third world seeking a better life and being offered that. You know, Siti Aisha was a single mother whose family and son were back home in her village in Indonesia, and she was doing whatever it took to make more money and be able to provide for her family. And that sort of sad journey through sweatshops and then sex work and then this reality show, which was a massive opportunity for her where she could make 10 times the amount that she was making in a day as a sex worker, massage therapist, provided her an incredible opportunity. And that, I think, is the universal story of disadvantaged women, young women, in most cases, that are vulnerable. And again, it's the worst case scenario version of that, but I do think it's universal in that way.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. Now, we were just talking about the downside of social media, but one of the most fascinating parts of this for me is the role that social media actually played in their defense. Do you think that they would have had much of a chance without that?
No, there's a lot of irony to this story. It's kind of like you're saying it would have played like a comedy in some ways. There's a lot of irony in this story, not only tonally of the juxtaposition of these prank shows versus this horrible assassination, but also with those themes you're talking about. Namely, I truly believe it is a cautionary tale about social media, but you're totally right that without the world of social media, we would be left to wonder whether these women are guilty. And that digital imprint in many ways proves their innocence. Likewise, there's an incredible irony in the sense that both of these women were desperately trying to be famous, and that led them to these circumstances, and they achieved their goal. You know, they are much more famous than they probably ever expected they would ever become from a prank show. But clearly they became famous for the darkest and most morbid of reasons. And so we were constantly having to grapple with those sort of dualities in the editing room of how do you straddle all of those worlds? How do you kind of walk that tightrope tonally, but also structurally? And, you know, the idea that because these women were so public on social media, they can prove their innocence is the ultimate irony. They're famous for all the wrong reasons, but just go look back at everything they were trying to do to be famous. And it kind of, I wouldn't say proves, but it definitely sheds light on the fact that they might be innocent.
And in addition to Dewan and Siti, the Malaysian police also had, I think, 8 North Korean suspects either in custody or suspects that they wanted for questioning pretty early on. Who were they and how did they slip through the authorities' fingers?
So Malaysia and North Korea have diplomatic relations. There's a North Korean embassy in Malaysia in Kuala Lumpur, and quite a lot of North Koreans working in Malaysia. So there were many, 4 of those people were living in Malaysia at the time, either working for the embassy or working for the North Korean National Airline. 4 of the others who we name in the film were more of the spies that were masking as Japanese YouTube producers and recruiting and conditioning the women for months. Those 4 men that played a direct role in the assassination, and by direct, I mean like they literally put the VX into the women's hands right before they assassinated Kim Jong-nam, or these are the men that you can see on cell phones immediately after he dies, presumably reporting back to headquarters. Those 4 guys escaped the country immediately after Kim Jong-nam died. You can see them going into bathrooms, changing their clothes, disguising themselves, facial hair disappears, there's new hats, and they get on flight paths back home to North Korea. The other 4 men were remaining in Malaysia and actually could have been held accountable alongside these women. But in a crazy turn of events, and this is something we investigate throughout the film, is why is Malaysia letting North Korea get away with this murder? Why do they seem hell-bent on convicting these two women who at most were tangential to the murder, you know? And why do they seem so so willing to ignore the political assassination part? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it plays out in this sort of crazy espionage way where there's a hostage crisis and there has to be a trade between North Korea starts holding Malaysians hostage in Pyongyang, and there has to be this trade, and Malaysia gave those suspects back to North Korea. So all eight of them, well, one of them is sort of a boogeyman that no one knows where he went, but all seven of them that we can track safely were returned to North Korea and therefore could never be held accountable for the crime. But yet the two women were left sitting in Malaysia as the only people that could be put on trial.
Yeah, like you said, the Malaysian government seemed almost too eager to throw these two young women under the bus. They let North Korean suspects slip through their hands, or they traded them for, you know, basically hostages, Malaysian hostages who were being held in North Korea. But they also kind of seemed afraid to point the finger at North Korea even after they had gotten their people back. Do you think that Malaysia was complicit in the cover-up? And if so, why? What was in it for them?
I don't know if I would go so far to say they were complicit. They very well could have been, but I definitely cannot prove that in any way. So to me, the most likely scenario, if we're assuming that Malaysia, you know, wasn't totally in bed in North Korea and a part of covering up this assassination, was that this was a huge public embarrassment for Malaysia, that such a prolific public figure had been assassinated in their major airport on camera. This was egg on the face of Malaysia as far as their national security goes, about how their police investigations go. And so, you know, I think the most likely scenario is that Malaysia understandably felt like they had to hold someone accountable, to let every actor off. And the fact of the matter is the two women were the only people left in their country that could be brought to trial. So to let every participant in this assassination off, I think was too risky for Malaysia to make it look like everybody got away with it. And therefore it seemed like it was a way to shut and end this case, sweep it under the rug and say not everybody got away with it, even if that meant that two women might be executed even though they were innocent.
Mm-hmm. And in Malaysia, their justice system works a little bit differently than ours does. And it really seems stacked against these two young women. And there are just so many powerful forces, it seems, working behind the scenes to make them the scapegoats. Were you ever pessimistic about their odds of walking free? Because they would have been executed by hanging, right, if they had been convicted.
Yeah, and I would be lying if I said I was ever optimistic about their chances. And that's because from the very beginning, when I went to Malaysia in 2017, everybody was saying, oh, these women are going to be convicted. And the longer the trial went on, the more it pointed in that direction, the more it was obvious that the prosecution was presenting a one-sided case, or the judge, it's the British system of law. There's no jury system in Malaysia. So the judge made a ruling after the prosecution put up its case. And his ruling was eviscerating of the women's defense that they thought they were playing a prank. He emphatically did not believe them, and he was going to be the one ultimately deciding their fate. So the longer the trial went on, the more we were all resigning ourselves to the fact that that was the ending, that the women would be assassinated. And so, you know, like we began this conversation by saying, I think most people don't know this story and how it unfolded. So I don't want to ruin the end for your listeners, but it was a sort of shocking, totally out of nowhere twist of events that happened at the end of this trial that, without being dramatic, is the most shocking moment of my filmmaking career, how it all went down, that kind of leads to how this story, you know, nothing gets tied up with a pretty bow for sure in this story. And I will never claim that justice was served, because Kim Jong-nam his perpetrators will never receive justice for assassinating him. But it ended in the most surprising of ways based on where we all thought it was going.
Yeah, talk about a twist. Now, some of the real heroes of this film are the attorneys who fought for City and Duan. You had an extraordinary amount of access to the defense team during the trial. How did you persuade them to let you in on everything?
Well, that goes to what we were just talking about. I think they couldn't say this publicly. They would never say it to me. It was journalists and officials that were saying these women are going to be convicted. Of course, mm-hmm. their defense attorneys aren't going to be saying that to a documentary filmmaker because they need to project, a case of optimism and that they have this. So they were never saying that to me personally on camera. But I think they recognized that the odds were stacked against them and that the Malaysian government was ignoring the truth. And therefore, none of this ever came out in the trial. None of the truth of the women's defense was ever allowed to come out in the courtroom. None of the North Korean involvement. They wouldn't even name who the North Korean men were in the courtroom. They wouldn't even name who Kim Jong-nam was as a victim. They were using the name from his fake passport. So I think the lawyers recognized an opportunity and perhaps a Hail Mary in some ways, that if their clients were convicted, which was the likelihood, and therefore were going to face death by hanging, why not take these desperate measures to completely open up your files to a documentary filmmaker if you deeply believe in your client's innocence? And likewise, the two women's families, I think, felt the same way. I think they were desperate. So I think they had this notion of what do we have to lose? And also, we have nothing to hide. These women have nothing to hide. So have at it, documentary filmmakers. Here's everything. Why don't you take all of this? And because it's not coming out within, the borders of Malaysia, try to take it outside of Malaysia and get the story out there.
As you mentioned, for reasons that people will see in the film, most of the evidence that might have exonerated Duan and City never saw the light of day in the trial. Since they never really had their day in court in that sense, do you feel an added responsibility to set the record straight and clear their names in the court of public opinion?
That's an interesting question, because I don't feel like it's my responsibility to clear their names.
Okay.
I think that's their legal team's responsibility. And I don't think myself as a storyteller that I could ever take on that type of mission. But my duty as a storyteller is to tell a story as fully as I can. So I have no problem, saying that I believe these women were innocent, based on everything I've seen. But I hope our film also leaves open the opportunity, because I would never unequivocally say, oh, they aren't those Black Widow assassins that tricked everyone. And we might not find out in 10 years that they really were, deep double agents for the North Korean regime. That is possible. But my job, I think, as the filmmaker was to present all of the evidence that I could find, all of the lack of evidence that I could find, which was, I think, was a huge part of this case, too. The prosecution never showed one shred of evidence pointing to their guilt. And to lay that out there, and hopefully the audience can decide by watching this film. And, like I said, I believe these women are innocent, but I've already had many viewers of my films and journalists who watch my film and interpreted it otherwise.
Oh, really?
So I think there is room for interpretation. I hope the women, if it's about clearing their names, I hope that they can do that. Maybe my film will play a part in that, but I hope that they can do that themselves over the coming years when they, get to tell their stories more fully.
I imagine this must have been challenging for you as a filmmaker. What was it like to make a movie about these two young women and be so intimately involved in their fate without having any direct interaction with their subjects throughout the whole process?
Yeah, I mean, what a strange way to make a documentary, because documentaries are all about access. And, I think I've made over 10 films now, and it's all about that intimacy you establish with your subject and that trust. And these were women living in solitary confinement on death row who I never even got to say hello to. I would see them enter a courthouse every day in bulletproof vests, surrounded by dozens of Malaysian soldiers holding AK-47s. And that was it. So I felt like if they were mystery women when the headline came out, they remained that way to me, even in the 2 years of documenting their backstories, but never actually getting to speak face to face with them. So again, not trying to ruin the end, but I do make contact with both of them at some point. And what I will say was there was nothing more humanizing than actually getting to speak to them both face to face and realize that these hyped up femme fatale mystery women were just sitting in front of me, you know, in a village or in a hotel room, you know, starting at the beginning. And that's when you realize, like, man, how often does this happen in the world where we make snap judgments based on our perceptions or the media portrayal of something? And if you could only pull back the curtain and really let the world get to know participants in any of these sort of sensational international stories, what really kind of lies beneath. And so meeting them was one of the most special moments of my filmmaking career, you know, two of the most special moments.
Going into this, knowing what you were getting into with a person like, presumably the person behind this, Kim Jong-un in North Korea, the fact that they had just killed his brother and had assassinated other people. Did you find any need to take extra security precautions, either in real life or digitally, when you were making this movie?
Oh, 100%. We had to take incredible amounts of precautions in making this film. And it's not, you know, it's not my first investigative piece. I did a series for Netflix called The Keepers a few years ago, which, you know, kind of took on the Catholic Church and the Baltimore Police Department. And I remember when I told my mom about assassins, she was like, "Are you kidding me? Like, we just got out of the crosshairs of the Catholic Church and the Baltimore Police Department. You're going to up the ante with the North Korean regime." But we had to be incredibly careful while we were making it. I'll never claim that I wasn't afraid while we were making it, either for our physical safety and definitely for our cybersecurity. We had the FBI consult on this film. There were many times that I felt like I was living in an espionage film, you know, because my access was an investigative journalist who had been covering the North Korean beat for a long time. His name's Doug Bot Clark. And he taught me a lot about the precautions that we had to take in making sure that we made this film safely. So I could give you a million examples that sound like a spy film that we had to do either in a precautionary way to keep this film safe or to keep our own physical safety. And I mean, I can tell you, no one's happier than my mom that this film is finally at the finish line. And that it's finally seeing the light of day and that I'm not, you know, on the ground there following that story anymore.
I wonder, because of the subject matter, was it hard to find a distributor for this movie? I mean, look what happened to Sony when they released The Interview, which made fun of Kim Jong-un. Was that ever a concern for your partners?
Yeah, I mean, it was a huge concern. It's an understandable concern. The Sony hack was, you know, one of the most disruptive forces in Hollywood probably in the last 10 years. And so it's the Kim regime is incredibly threatening to Hollywood. And we felt that all the time in these meetings. There were many people not even willing to look at our film because of that. So I think, you know, I think that's understandable. I was afraid of the Kim regime while I was doing it. So I understand if massive media companies are that, you know, have a lot more important roles to society than just a solo documentary filmmaker does. So I feel like it presented us a really unique opportunity, though, because I've been very lucky over my filmmaking career. You know, all my past few projects have had huge streaming platforms behind them, which come with huge marketing budgets and a huge amount of security and safety that come with that. And so it's a little bit of a throwback to the beginning of my career having a film like this. You know, our distributor is a great one. It's Greenwich Entertainment, and they're incredibly brave to take on this film. But they're, you know, a scrappy theatrical company that's not, you know, padded with tons of marketing budget and, you know, all the bells and whistles I've been spoiled with over the last few years. So I'm kind of excited to take this film out into the world in a way where it's not a slam dunk. You know, I think I've made true crime stories before, and I know that they have the possibility to spread by word of mouth. And I kind of see this one as this scrappy little film that people are afraid of, but I'm hopeful that audiences aren't going to be afraid of watching it, so that it finds an audience, you know, through word of mouth and through all these, you know, less traditional channels, whether that's virtual cinema or video on demand. I hope it kind of builds an audience in sort of that old school type of way from the beginning of my career.
Yeah, it's a fantastic story, a really great film. Before we go, You know, what's the official word from the Malaysian government at this point? Is there any kind of ongoing investigation into other suspects, or is this just a closed case at this point?
It's not closed, and the women have to be very careful because it's not closed. You know, again, I'm trying to be careful of ruining the ending, but one woman's story is way more open than the other woman. So they have to always be careful. I don't think they'll ever return to Malaysia because, you know, they could still be charged. Well, one of them could still be charged with this murder. As far as North Korea goes, you know, your guess is as good as mine. My guess is Malaysia is breathing a massive sigh of relief that this story is out of their borders now. You know, it took such a bizarre path in the end, but I think Malaysia in the end did the right thing. And I think they're being recognized for that. And that's not all, you know, on their own volition. There was also a government change in Malaysia while this all went down that played a massive role. There were huge amounts of pressure from foreign governments on Malaysia to affect the outcome. But my guess is that Malaysia's just breathing a big sigh of relief that this story is not theirs anymore and that they can move on. And I'm sure they are very hopeful that nothing like this ever happens on their soil again. And my guess is they have made that very clear to North Korea, because North Korea counts on Malaysia in a lot of ways, that this can never happen again.
Interesting. Well, again, Ryan White's film Assassins opens in theaters December 11th and then on video on demand January 15th. Ryan, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you, Ben. Take care.
Thanks again to Ryan White for coming on the show. Assassins is now showing in theaters and available on video on demand starting January 15th. Follow Ryan White on Twitter at RyanWhite4th and his website, tripod/media.com. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickassNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.